Where do you see your career in 10 years? What are you doing now to help you get there? The sooner you start enhancing your skills, the sooner you'll be ready. That's why AARP has reskilling courses in a variety of categories like marketing and management to help your income live as long as you do.
That's right. AARP has a bevy of free skill building courses for you to choose from because the steps that you choose to take today will help you to love what you do in the future. And that's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills. In recent weeks, we've really focused on some ways that listeners can boost their income. So whether that's through starting your own side business and growing your network like Hala talked about, or when we talked with local realtor Alan about diving into investing in real estate, well, what better way to test the waters? While you are away, your home could also earn extra income.
That's right. Your empty space could be an Airbnb while you're traveling, because that's all you need to become an Airbnb host. It's a lot easier than you think, and you don't need to Airbnb your entire house. You could just host your extra spare room. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Supercharge your work decks with AI-powered Canva presentations. All you do is start with a prompt. You describe your presentation in a few words, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides that you can then customize in seconds.
Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation with AI.
Generate slides in seconds with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today, this is the Bitcoin episode for normies with Marco from Whiteboard Finance.
So I'm not opposed if we start naming our episodes in the like Friends fashion, right? Where they're like the refrigerator episode. But honestly, it makes me think about how last week we went all in on real estate. That's what we talked about. But that's actually not what we're doing today with Bitcoin. That being said, we are going to discuss how investing in Bitcoin can not only be lucrative, but also just a simply balanced and healthy strategy for investors today. And here to share how it's done is Marco from Whiteboard Finance. So Marco, he was self-taught. He started investing in the market at the age of 18, back when you had to pay for trades. But then after studying finance, working for tech startups and working in banking, he launched his own YouTube channel, which is actually just shy of 1 million subscribers. And so hopefully, maybe this episode will get him to that next milestone. But he is an expert of all things personal finance, but we're mainly going to focus on the future of Bitcoin. We're going to talk about the recent events that might be responsible for it blowing up. We're going to talk about how much Bitcoin you should own and more today. Marco, thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, guys. I appreciate you inviting me on.
Of course. Yeah, you're like the Mr. Beast of the personal finance space on YouTube. Is that right?
Well, if Mr. Beast is the most entertaining person on YouTube, and my channel is somewhere in the middle between Mr. Beast and the most boring classroom you've ever sat in. So somewhere in the middle.
All right, that's the balance we all have to strike here.
If you start giving away millions, I think that'll probably up your numbers. Just a little bit of outside advice, even though you don't need it. Our first question, though, Marco, to every guest who comes on the show is, what's your craft beer equipment? And by that, we mean, what do you like to splurge on in the here and now while you're diligently saving and investing for your future?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I would say it's two things. So one is travel. I think travel is very important. I think the more you travel, it's kind of like a horse with the blinders on. The more you travel, the more those blinders are taken off. And you can see that pretty much everyone around the world is pretty similar and they value similar things. Hmm. So I enjoy traveling. And then also I like grilling. So I have two very expensive custom-made grills. Ooh. And I get a lot of pleasure out of them. And so does my family and friends. So yeah, it's travel and good food.
When are you going to invite us over, Marco? Because that sounds awesome.
For real.
So whatever you want. I got a pellet grill for low and slow. And then yes. I have an adjustable charcoal grill. So we can do, hot and fast. We can do direct heat. We can do whatever you guys want.
Okay, so this is something that Joel and I both have taken on over the past couple years, but yeah. Getting into smoking meats, I literally just ate some leftover brisket that I smoked this past weekend. What's your favorite cut?
Nice. So for low and slow, I really like beef ribs. So think of like Fred Flintstone when he puts the big rack of ribs in his car and it tips over. Beef ribs are good. And then for more like hot and fast, you can't beat a good ribeye.
Yes. Oh, my gosh.
We're on the same page.
We could not be in more agreement. Marco, I love it. Okay. I feel like we could accidentally spend the next 30 minutes talking about meat, but maybe we'll save that for the post show, but the post interview. But I want to talk about your personal history, Marco, because it sounded like your financial pedigree started early, specifically with Pokemon cards. Share how that got kicked off, basically.
Yeah, so for reference, probably aging myself, but I don't care. I'm 36. So I was born in 87. And when I was a kid, I was probably like 11, 12 years old in middle school when Pokemon really took off. So it started with the video games, then with the trading cards. And then my dad actually came back from a trip. He worked for Dirt Devil. So if you guys remember the vacuum company.
Yeah.
So he was a mechanical engineer. He went to Hong Kong, Shanghai, and he came back with like all these ridiculously rare Pokemon cards, but I didn't realize this at the time because I was a kid. He was coming back with like Charizards and all these, you know, cards that are very highly valued. And I'm like, you know what? I have so many of these things. Why don't I just sell them? And then I think I realized this may or may not have been the case, but I'm guessing it was the case because there's just way too many rare cards for them to be legit. I just think that they were like copies. So like I inevitably, unknowingly was, you know, selling just, you know, rare cards, trading cards, things like that. So I put a big poster board on my mailbox in my neighborhood. And I live on a main road growing up. So all these people would see this sign. It's like Pokemon cards for sale. And it was all the craze. So I would just sell, you know, Pokemon cards that I was buying from packs, some that my dad brought back from China. So that was like my first endeavor into entrepreneurship. And then also like mixtape CDs. If you guys remember the days of like LimeWire and Kazaa and Napster and all that stuff. So,
oh my gosh, yeah.
Yeah, just hustling, man. Just entrepreneurial. And some kids sell candy. I was selling Pokemon cards and mixtapes.
Yeah. Well, you got to tell yourself that those were knockoffs because you're like, no, if only I would have held on to those and kept them wrapped up in the plastic. I'm sure I don't know anything about Pokemon, but I'm sure they would have been worth vast multiples of that 10, 20 yeah. years down the road.
Oh, yeah. Fast forward 20, 25 years later, man. It's like, who knows what those are going for now on eBay.
For real. And they're hot again, too, right? So, because everything, nostalgia's back. What caused you to launch a YouTube channel? And then, like, whiteboard finance, like, at least started off where you're teaching lessons on a whiteboard, which sounds like going back to high school. So, like, why was that kind of the way you wanted to present information?
Yeah, so my background in a nutshell is, like you said in the intro, I've been investing since 2006, since I was 18. I opened up a Trade King account. It's when you actually had to, like, scan documents, like, you know, a driver's license and, you know, all this stuff. It was kind of funny. And you physically mailed it to the brokerage, and then you'd hear back, like, a week or two later and saying, oh, hey, this is your login credentials, right? Now you can just download an app in 2 seconds and start, you know, degen gambling on whatever you want. but basically, my story in a nutshell was I got a finance degree, started in 06, graduated in 2010, and I got that finance degree because I enjoy teaching and I wanted to be a financial advisor. So ultimately, I never actually ended up scratching that itch because I graduated into one of the highest unemployment rates in recent history. This was December of 2010. I think unemployment was close to 10%. It was right after the global financial crisis. And ended up selling cars, ended up working in commercial real estate development, commercial real estate lending, you know, commercial mortgage-backed securities, things like that. And I never really scratched the itch of being that financial advisor. So I always had a passion for like personal finance, investing, you know, different types of ways to, I guess, make money, if you will. So I had this DSLR camera that I bought for photography. It was just simply for a hobby for my wife and I. And I never really used it. You know, it was collecting dust. So I'm like, hey, I have this really nice DSLR. You know, I enjoy teaching. You know, what's the natural segue to teaching? It's the classroom setting, as I mentioned earlier, which, you know, I could go like the chalkboard, but that would be really annoying and, you know, piss my wife off or make her angry. So I went with the dry erase board, you know, much more logical. You get way more use out of it. So yeah, I ended up going on Craigslist, bought a huge whiteboard with my brother-in-law and I. We put it on the roof of my car, and it was too big for my trunk. So we actually did this in February, and I'm in Cleveland. So we're like getting frostbite on our hand, you know, holding this whiteboard on the top of the car. Yeah, set it up in my studio. And the rest is history. So the reason for the whiteboard is because I think people pay attention in a classroom setting, especially if you know what you're talking about or if you can simplify perceived to be complex items. And that's kind of like my biggest compliment that I get from my viewers. It's like, hey, you have the ability to break this down. I don't even speak English. It's my second or third language. And even I understand what you're saying. So I like that classroom setting.
I dig it. Yeah. When you see a whiteboard, you know that you're in to learn something. And that's what you've been able to convey and what you've established there with your channel. So congrats with that.
Thank you.
Let's talk about Bitcoin.
Okay.
Marco, specifically. Because when we messaged you originally and you said that you could talk about Bitcoin specifically, but we made the error of saying, I guess, crypto, generally speaking, which isn't necessarily your specialty, right? And there are a lot of folks out there like us that tend to lump those two things together. And so can you draw a distinction between all other forms of crypto versus Bitcoin for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So in that finance journey, I kind of went down the rabbit hole of kind of like Austrian economics, which is more of like a sound money. So if you think of like money backed by gold, for example, or hard money. Now we have fiat currency, which is literally just decreed by the government. So there's a difference between money and currency. Anything can be money. Like I can trade you my cell phone for your Pokemon card, and in that transaction, those two things were money, right? With currency is just, especially fiat currency, is just decreed by the government. So what is our currency backed by? Some people would argue, without going too, you know, geopolitical or, you know, political in general, you know, we printed trillions of dollars after the lockdowns of 2020. Why didn't our currency hyperinflate? Well, it's because the United States is the global reserve currency. That happened with Bretton Woods after World War II. Europe and the rest of the world was essentially a parking lot, and United States was the next superpower that was really unscathed after World War II. So United States becomes the base layer of money. So base layer of money, think of it like gold. If you think of a pyramid, gold is on the bottom. And then what do you, people aren't going to carry around gold, so what do they do? We obviously have dollars, right? It's just representative of the gold that's inside the vaults or that the bank is supposed to have, right? In 1971, we got off the gold standard, thus creating fiat currency. So now the money is backed by, hopefully, tax receipts, your GDP, your ability to be a good economy, you know, world reserve currency, which is currently the dollar. But it's also backed by a lot more than that. It's petrodollars. Most oil is traded in dollars. We've been in war forever, never-ending wars. There's just a lot of things that back the dollar outside of just, hey, the United States is a strong economy, right? So we don't have to go down that rabbit hole. But the reason I'm prefacing your question with all this is because I think it's important for people to understand what sound money and hard money is versus just, let's call it crypto. So in my opinion, Bitcoin is the hardest form of money ever created. So what do I mean by that? And what is hard money? So the traits of money are that it's fungible, meaning it's interchangeable. So no matter what, a $10 bill is a $10 bill, and a $10 bill is going to buy you $10 worth of stuff all throughout the nation or all throughout the world, right? There's not different versions of a $10 bill. It's non-consumable, so it's not like wheat or fish that can rot. It's portable. You know, that's why we went from having gold in our pockets to dollar bills, because you can put it in a billfold or a wallet. It's durable. You know, the dollars, yes, they can catch on fire or get wet or do whatever, but that's why gold is very durable. It's highly divisible. We have dollars and cents. And then it's secure, it's easily transactable, and it's scarce, which fiat money is not. So in my opinion, Bitcoin, if you look at a chart of all these different traits of money, Bitcoin checks the box for literally every single one of these. And it's also decentralized. It's not owned by any certain person. So when you look at Bitcoin, not crypto, crypto has ICOs, initial coin offerings. They have marketing teams behind them. They have teams of developers. They have people that pump them on Instagram, on Twitter, on social media, on X, whatever you want to call it. A lot of them is just creating hype for exit liquidity. So, hey, check out this really cool Shiba Inu coin, right? Check out Dogecoin, check out whatever. Those are all essentially just lottery tickets, in my opinion. Only Bitcoin can be hard money. There's other forms of Bitcoin. There's Litecoin, there's Bitcoin Cash. There's a million different forks of Bitcoin. But what people need to realize is the story and the network effects behind Bitcoin is that there is no centralized agency that created it. There is no founder. There is no Vitalik Buterin who created Ethereum. There is no Charles Hoskinson who created Cardano. It's Satoshi Nakamoto, who no one knows who that is. It's just a pseudonymous pen name on these forums and these emails when Bitcoin was in its infancy being created in 2008. Then it gave birth in 2009, which is the Genesis block, and then that story has survived ever since 15 years later. So a lot of people compare it to like a cult or religion, and I guess you can see that in a lot of different ways. But the beauty behind Bitcoin is that no one knows who created it, and it's just open source code. So you and I can go on GitHub or whatever and just literally look at Bitcoin's code and see how it works. We can create our own Bitcoin, right? We can create our own rules, but no one's going to want to play with you if you play, if you change the rules of chess. You know, Matt and Joel could love chess. I could love chess. But if I say, you know, a pawn has infinite possibilities to move and I create my own version of chess, well, then we're not playing chess, right? Yeah. So without getting super long-winded, I just think that in my humble opinion, the network effects of so many people adopting it at this point, 15 years later, Lindy effect, meaning that a technology that's been kind of like the forefront of that sector has been alive for so long, it gets harder to kill as time goes on. Yeah. And then also not having a single creator or founder that's publicly known, is just all the check boxes of what could be, you know, who knows what it could be 15 years from now. But in my opinion, it's the hardest form of money ever created. And at minimum, it's a great savings technology.
Talk to me about the difference between Bitcoin as currency and Bitcoin as an investment. Because to be a currency, and you need some stability there as well, right? Granted, inflation happens, but typically that the cycle of inflation is pretty understandable, and until you know, the printing of money during the COVID lockdowns. But some people think of Bitcoin as this speculative asset. They're hoping the number goes up. And then there are other places like the Bitcoin Beach, for instance, where it's trying to be used as like the way that you transact. You use Bitcoin to buy and sell things. It's hard for me to wrap my mind around the fact that it's kind of sort of trying to serve two purposes.
So I think Bitcoin is kind of email in 1993 right now, or 1995. It's kind of like when you're on the Today Show and they're like, oh, I just sent an email and it's magic digital mail, right? Okay, great. More to you, Cynthia. More at 6, later at 6, right? And everyone's just like, they kind of brush it off, right?
It's almost like a joke.
It's almost like a joke.
And now
we all
need to use it regularly.
And then everyone uses email every single day, right? So I think Bitcoin is still in its infancy, and it's going through that process of being a store of value to be able to be a currency. The thing that people have to realize is that if you don't understand the technology behind it, I would recommend the book Inventing Bitcoin by Jan Pritzker. It's kind of like a layman's guide to understanding the technology behind Bitcoin without being a computer programmer, if that makes sense. So to answer your question, it is money. It can be money. People use it to transact all the time. Currency is when it becomes a little bit more mainstream. Currencies are typically dictated by governments. So like, hey, the US dollar is the currency of the United States, and it can be the currency in other countries as well. So I don't think Bitcoin is there yet because of the protocol. So the protocol, there's things called blocks. There's a million different things that I can go into, but without losing your audience, just think of layers, okay? So when you think of like MasterCard, credit card, Visa, that's not the U.S. dollar. You're transacting in U.S. dollars, but that's a different layer on top of the dollar, right? So if you think of the pyramid that I talked about earlier, you have layers of money. So it used to be gold, and then it was dollars, and then it was, you know, whatever you want to call it. Now we have digital dollars. I'd say 98% of dollars are digital. They're just ones and zeros. Every time you use your credit card, you're just using a digital form of the dollar that doesn't settle for days later. Or if you try and move money from a bank account to another, it doesn't get there right away. It takes days. So you are just using the digital layer of the dollar, right? So we have, let's call it, you know, the US dollar. And on top of that, we have other platforms like Visa, PayPal, Stripe, Venmo, whatever example you want to use. So once those layer two solutions on top of the Bitcoin protocol, such as like Lightning, there's Aqua Wallet, there's a bunch of different solutions that are becoming more and more available. Jack Dorsey just tweeted literally 3-4 days ago that I think they came out with BitKey or whatever it's called. That's going to be his solution to easily custody Bitcoin and use it as currency, right? So we don't think about how our phones work. If I were to send Matt or Joel a text message, do I understand everything that's going on behind the scenes to be able to send that text message or that emoji or that GIF? Obviously not, but we use it every day. People don't know SMTP or whatever the protocol that email runs on, right? We just send the email, right? So Bitcoin's so early, people are still having a hard time understanding how it can become that currency until it's so ingrained in our culture that we won't even think twice about how it works, if that makes sense. No,
it does, yeah. And as more applications are built and it's created in such a way that makes it easier for folks, I think a lot of folks do have a hard time wrapping their head around it. But I want to go back to what you said, like when you're talking about fiat currency, you're talking about essentially it exists because it was decreed by a government. And so much of the power of a fiat currency comes down to belief and trust. Like that is a huge part of what makes money work. And so, and again, you were talking about like the network effect. So how important is the growing, just the growing belief to the value of Bitcoin and its price, essentially?
Well, the beauty of it is that you don't have to believe anything. Bitcoin is trustless. There is no trust involved. Every time I use a dollar or deposit my money in a bank and hope to get it out, I'm trusting a third party, right? So someone asked me inside my community, they asked me, well, I want to store my seed phrase, the private keys that allow me to access my Bitcoin on a wallet, right? Anywhere in the world. I want to store that in a vault in a bank, right? I'm like, well, then you're trusting the bank, right? So every time that we're trusting a third party, that involves trust. I need to be able to trust Matt and Joel, right? Matt and Joel need to be able to trust me. With Bitcoin, this all lives on the mempool. The mempool is just all the different blocks, all the transactions. It's completely transparent currency. You can see what any address sent anyone at any time. I guess to answer your question, Bitcoin is trustless and Bitcoin is for enemies. You don't have to trust each other. You know, Russia and China and United States can transact on Bitcoin because it's literally just math. It's literally just blocks of information on an open source ledger. There's no behind the scenes deals. There's no money going to Ukraine. There's no money going under the table here. There's no money going there. It's just, if you know who owns the address, you know exactly what's going on.
How does the growing printing of money in this country, the growing national debt, how does that maybe influence your belief in Bitcoin? Is that part of people's disillusionment with the US dollar and thinking that we need a harder form of currency?
Yeah, I think people don't understand that if you just pull up a chart, people can do this. If you just Google like Federal Reserve balance sheet, we've added trillions. Our lizard brains can't even comprehend how big of a number a trillion is. It's 1,000 billions. We've added thousands of billions of dollars to the Federal Reserve's balance sheet just by, you know, buying treasuries, right? That's what the Fed does. So people in this country, they're funny because they always have, you know, certain thoughts about like socialism and central planning and we're not communists and this and that. Well, it's called a central bank, okay? we don't know the monetary policy of the Fed. Bitcoin's protocol halves every 210,000 blocks. It's called a halving. It's going to happen April 20th. We know Bitcoin's monetary policy until the year 2140, okay? So miners, they're rewarded in Bitcoin by verifying blocks. So right now, the daily issuance of Bitcoin is 900 Bitcoin per day, roughly 6.5. It started with 50, then 25, then 12.5, then 6.25. Then it's going to go to 3 1/8 for the next 210,000 blocks. So without getting too technical and losing your audience, we know Bitcoin's monetary policy until the year 2140. We don't know what the Fed is doing literally hours from now. Okay.
Wow. So the predictability factor is huge.
Yeah. Say you're a small business and you went through COVID. Say you're a restaurant. How many businesses went out of business during COVID? A lot, because they couldn't predict something like that, right? Inflation went crazy. Cost of goods went crazy. If you're on a deflationary or disinflationary money like Bitcoin, you can kind of make better business decisions and spend your time more wisely as a business owner because you know what the money's going to do, right? Inflation is actually going to go down on a Bitcoin standard. And I'm not some advocate for a Bitcoin standard or hyper-Bitcoinization or anything like that. I think fiat and Bitcoin can live together. But the one thing I wanted to make your audience aware of is that I think the worst case scenario for Bitcoin, in my humble opinion, is just eating up the monetary premium of gold. So when you look at monetary premium, all that means is that, hey, this thing has value above and beyond its intrinsic value because people are using it as money. So when people complain about high real estate prices, you know, single moms are getting priced out by BlackRock, for example, or you know, let's look at gold, for example. I'd say 80% of gold's value is just from its monetary premium. It's not really used that much in industrial applications. It's mostly used as jewelry. And the rest of that value comes from people saving in it because it's been hard money for 5,000 years. I think Bitcoin is inevitably going to suck up all that monetary premium from things that shouldn't be used as money in the first place, like a single family home, for example, with speculators and investors. And the base case, in my opinion, is going to be gold's market cap is 10x of what Bitcoin's is. Gold is roughly 11, 12 trillion at the time of this recording. Bitcoin is roughly 1.3 trillion at the time of this recording. In my humble opinion, and I know this sounds insane if you haven't done the work, but I think Bitcoin still has 10x to go because it's simply just going to meet the market cap of gold. And then you can look at other assets as well, you know, stocks, bonds, real estate, things like that. So just look at it as a monetary premium, and Bitcoin is the monetary premium vacuum cleaner.
I like it. I mean, it makes sense, and it it goes to explain a little bit why Bitcoin's referred to as digital gold, the way that you've explained it here. But Marco, we've got more to get to. Specifically, we want to touch on Vanguard and their opinion of Bitcoin. We've got more to get to with you right after this. When it comes to financial advice, you got to trust the source. That's why you listen to this podcast. And if you're looking to upgrade your wallet, you need to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. If you're paying for vacations with whatever card is in your wallet, you could be missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table.
You can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade, lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions.
Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week at the beach. Every single summer, we've already got that trip to St. Simons on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host, or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. And now a word from the show sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry, Betterment is here to help.
Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again.
Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. All right, we're back. We're still talking about Bitcoin, hopefully in a basic enough level that we can all understand it. Matt and I think we would also call ourselves noobs in this space. But Marco from Whiteboard Finance has been kind enough to join us to walk through a bunch of stuff, and I'm already learning a lot. So Marco, let's talk about Bitcoin ETFs. How, and especially because the number going up sort of thing is what lends a spotlight again on Bitcoin. How do you think that's impacting prices? And isn't that also kind of the opposite of the goal of Bitcoin, the decentralized finance part of it?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So I think obviously the number has gone up since the ETFs were approved on January 11th of 2024. So there was a little bit of a dip, I think, to like 38,000. And then now we're sitting roughly at, I'd say, 64,000 at the time of this recording, which we hit a new all-time high before the halving of, I think, 73.5, right around there. So, we just have more money going into Bitcoin. So what people need to realize is that Bitcoin is, it's specifically scarce. So there's only 21 million Bitcoin ever to be released into circulation. And I'd say about like 3 to 4 million of those have been lost. Maybe a little bit less, but let's just say there's 19 million Bitcoin that's, you know, that people are able to use or recover. So what people need to realize, it's just a simple supply and demand equation, and the price of Bitcoin, it's 365 days a year, 24/7, does not trade just Monday through Friday like a typical asset. The ETFs do, but Bitcoin does not. So what people need to realize is that if you have all these ETFs adding hundreds of millions of dollars a day into new flow into Bitcoin, since there's only 21 million ever, I think right now there's only about like 19 something in circulation based on the halving numbers, minus whatever has been lost that I referred to earlier, then it's just simple supply and demand. So number is going to go up. So Bitcoin is about up 130, 135% year over year at this point. And it's up something crazy year to date as well. But I think what people need to realize is that you're going to get so many more passive flows from people that are now more comfortable using a traditional brokerage to buy IBIT, you know, BlackRock's ETF offering, for example. So I believe there's 11 total ETFs, of which I think 8 of those Coinbase is the custodian, which kind of creates some of that concentration risk that you guys were talking about. But basically, it's just a simple supply and demand equation. So if there's more inflows and less outflows on these exchanges or into these ETFs, the Bitcoin number is typically going to go up and to the right.
Makes sense. Yeah. Going back to the scarcity aspect. But let's talk about, I mentioned Vanguard before the break. On one hand, you've got Vanguard, and on the other hand, you've got Fidelity. They obviously seem to be taking different paths, but you're predicting essentially that more and more folks are going to be are interested in Bitcoin. And it sounds like that the different brokerages that are not participating in that, I mean, it seems like they're just going to be left in the dust.
Yeah, they very well could be. I mean, I understand. So if you guys have ever been on a Boglehead forum, so Jack Bogle is the founder of Vanguard. So there's a whole forum dedicated to him called the Bogleheads and the whole different investment philosophy. So he's typically a proponent of the three fund portfolio. So you have global stocks or international stocks, excuse me, ex-US, then you have total US stock market, and then you have bonds, right? So that's typically the Boglehead three fund portfolio. If you guys have ever been on a Boglehead forum and looked at the conversations around Bitcoin or crypto in general, people, they don't do the work, and it's just very unproductive conversations over there. So I can see why, from pandering to their customer base, I understand why Vanguard is not, I don't want to say accepting. They're just not even giving the people the option to invest in these.
Mm-hmm. They're not even considering it.
They're not even considering it, exactly. So ultimately, I understand. It's kind of like, you know, if McDonald's started making, I don't know.
Spinach bites.
Yeah, spinach bites, quinoa bites. Yeah, it's like obviously you're not pandering to your customer base. So I understand why Vanguard is doing it. I just think that in this age now where people are starting to wake up just a little bit in terms of what is money, you know, I want to be a little bit more diversified than just simply stocks, bonds, target date funds, you know, things like that. I think that they're kind of creating a competitive disadvantage to themselves, because if you think about game theory, say, for example, here's a perfect example. So China, they banned Bitcoin mining in 2021. All those miners, they're just opening up shop in the United States, Africa, Europe, you know, Asia, all over the place, right? They're just doing it somewhere else. So that's inevitably what's going to happen to Vanguard. People are just going to buy those funds from somewhere else.
Or go elsewhere.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think they're kind of potentially shooting themselves in the foot in the long term. In the near term, you know, I don't think most of their customers are going to care. But the one tweet I did see was this gentleman, when Bitcoin was pumping literally 50% earlier this year from a period of like 1 or 2 weeks, Vanguard actually got rid of all this gentleman's, I forgot what his holdings were. I think it was in the Bitcoin ETF, not the spot ETF, but I believe the futures one. And that pumped, everything pumped. And this guy's like, okay, I'm canceling my Vanguard account. I'm moving elsewhere. So that's just the mini microcosm of game theory playing out, in my opinion.
When you're more of a Bitcoin purist, you obviously have a lot of faith in it as an asset class and as a hard form of money. What would you say to somebody who's like, I feel like after this conversation, I need more Bitcoin exposure? We'll talk about like how to think about how much you have too, but should I be buying dollar cost averaging into one of these Bitcoin ETFs? Do I actually need to? I know there's like, you know, owning the Bitcoin itself, cold storage, that kind of stuff. Like how important is it just to have like exposure versus having owning it in the right way?
Yeah, that's a great question. So me, you know, the entire premise of, okay, let's just use gold for an example. Would you rather own physical gold bullion, or would you rather own a gold ETF, right? So in my opinion, owning the ETF defeats the purpose of the asset class in the first place.
I will say, though, that it makes it easier to buy and sell, because if you're saying you make your put your Pokemon sign out on the mailbox of your driveway, well, I have to do the same thing with my gold bar, right? Whereas it's so much easier to trade the ETF.
100%. But that's where Bitcoin is far superior to gold. It's divisible to 100 million places. I think calling it digital gold is almost like not giving Bitcoin nearly enough credit. It's just completely, it's like discovering the number zero, right? You only do that once. And that's why Bitcoin has kind of like a cult-like following, because it just takes all the properties of gold and just, it goes from analog, so like your cassette that you maybe used to listen to 15, 20, 30 years ago, and turning it into an MP3. That's all Bitcoin is doing to gold, but in a much, infinitely much better way, with the blocks, with the open ledger, with everything. So anyway, very quickly, I think that in my opinion, I don't think that I know that. I'd much rather custody my own Bitcoin and be my own sovereign individual and be my own bank, be my own wealth manager, be my own portfolio manager, than to rely on BlackRock sending me a screenshot of my Bitcoin, you know, quarterly or, you know, whatever that you want to look at it. So it's nice to know that you know, the phrase is not your keys, not your cheese, okay? Not the keys to your seed phrase, not your Bitcoin. And I think you're going to allude to another question of like how much Bitcoin should you own. There's a great website called NakamotoPortfolio.com. This is created by Swan Bitcoin. I would check it out because it gives you the ability to run tests of your current portfolio and what those results would be if you were to juice it up a little bit with Bitcoin. And you could add anywhere from 1% to 100%. I personally have Bitcoin is at least 15% of my net worth at all times. And then it far exceeds that once it pumps. And I don't have, this is going to sound wrong no matter how I say it. My net worth isn't 10 grand. Okay. My net worth is high, and it's at least 15% of my net worth at all times.
I would hope so, from the Mr. Beast of personal finance, you know?
Yeah. So my point is that I'm not just some like charlatan trying to sell you something. There's no kickback from the CEO of Bitcoin. Because there is no CEO. That's the beauty of it. Yeah. It's just something that I've studied for a very long time, and I think it answers a lot of questions in today's monetary system.
And that's why we want to have you on too, because you're a personal finance nerd. You talk about a lot of the stuff that Matt and I cover, and we have very similar philosophies. You're just more into Bitcoin than we are, and part of it is because, I don't know, I think Matt's probably done more work on this than me. I'm probably just like, again, Bitcoin noob. You also, one of the other things you talk about is the dollar cost averaging approach. So you're not about timing the market, even on Bitcoin, it seems like. It's regular, steady as you go, buying in at regular intervals, no matter what the price is doing, right?
I've been buying Bitcoin every week since 2018. I bought it at 2-3 grand, I bought it at 73 grand. I don't care. You know, I literally don't care, because I know what I'm buying, and I know what it is. And the way that your audience should think about this is that if, I know it's not video, but I'm holding up a circle with my hands. If you think of a pie or a pizza, you should have every asset slice as a asset class as a slice of that pizza. Okay. So for me, I have a 15% slice of Bitcoin. I have 35% stocks, 35% real estate, some precious metals, some collectibles, some you name it, right? You should define whatever the size of your slices are, and you should be okay with that slice going to zero. So if that slice goes to zero and you want to jump off a building or drink yourself to death, then that's too big of a slice, right? You need to create it to where you sleep well at night.
I mean, yeah, like I'm thinking about folks who are interested in it, like they're experiencing some of that FOMO because they're like, oh, man, I totally should have bought some more of it while it was, you know, in the dumps over the past year.
Can I go back in time to 2017?
Yeah. Well, like there are a lot of folks who are approaching it more from a speculative standpoint. But the way you're talking about it, you are treating it just like you are treating any other asset class. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I smash buy too. I mean, my dollar cost average is, you know, a certain amount. And I haven't deviated from that for 6 years now, 6.5 years. But yeah, I've bought many dips. You know, I post about it on Twitter. I just bought $1,000 yesterday. And I think it's important for your audience to understand, if you have a thesis on something and you have a general feeling that the probability is that you're right, you know, no one's right. No one has a crystal ball. But why would you deviate from that thesis unless proved otherwise, right? So for me, I guess for your audience, if you're going to go down this rabbit hole, I would highly recommend reading these certain books. I can name them either in the show notes or in the episode. But once you understand what you're buying, once you see it, it can't be unseen. It's just the solution to everything that's going on right now. So when you go to Longhorn Steakhouse and your steak is $21.99 five, 6 years ago, and now the same Outlaw ribeye is $31.99, there's a reason for that 50% increase, right? So the question that I would pose to your audience is, if you had $100,000 right now, do you think it's going to buy more or less 5 years from now? Obviously less, right? So yeah. If you have $100,000 in Bitcoin, you think it's going to be worth more or less in 5 years from now? And it's proven every four-year cycle to be multiples higher, right? So I'm not telling anyone to do anything. I could be 100% wrong. I don't think I am. But at the end of the day, if you're looking for a sound money that can't be debased by a few clicks by the Federal Reserve that prints trillions into your balance sheet, thus devaluing the value of your currency, then Bitcoin may be a good savings technology at the minimum, and then it may be a currency that sucks up the monetary premium of a lot of things in the future.
Sure. Okay, so getting to the to brass tacks, you've mentioned your 15%. Essentially, for you, that's how much you believe in it. I guess it varies, because you said, you know, as it shoots up, as it pumps, it's worth a lot more, and it's more of a percentage of your overall portfolio. But at this point, or maybe what you strive for and the balance that you're trying to strike, you believe in it up to 15%. And so,
oh, at minimum. And I don't call my position either. If it inflates to, you know, 25, 30, whatever, I never sell.
You're not rebalancing. Yeah.
Yeah. I've sold Bitcoin literally once in my life. I sold half of Bitcoin a couple years ago, and then I just ended up smash buying it right back. So it's different, man. It changes you as a person, because you have to realize is time preference. So this may be a new concept to your audience. When your money is being devalued, you have high time preference. You need to do something with that money. You make decisions today to, you know, to satiate your needs today. When you know that your money can't be debased, you make long-term decisions, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like building a ship in a shipyard that takes years, as opposed to, you know what, my money's not worth anything. Let me buy some crap coin, you know? Again, it's establishing what percentage you're comfortable with of your net worth going to zero, which I don't think is going to happen. If I didn't have a wife and kids, I'd probably be significantly higher. But
no, that's
the goal of my channel, it's very simple. It's I'm a traditional finance guy. I understand that the chart is going to go up and to the right as long as we have U.S. dollar dominance, right? Petrodollar, big military wars, high demand internationally for dollars. Like, let's just use a quick example so I don't lose your audience. If I'm a manufacturing firm in Colombia and I have the ability to borrow pesos, Colombian pesos at 9%, or I can borrow in U.S. dollars at 6.5%, on what planet would that business decision make to borrow in pesos when I can borrow in mm-hmm. dollars, right? Now, multiply that example for the entire world. If you look at Lebanon right now, Lebanon's going through quasi, you know, hyperinflation. Look at Turkey, look at Argentina. Argentina, I think, is at like 270% inflation over the last couple of years. They're getting rid of their crap coin, aka the lira, the pound, the peso, to pay for their day-to-day stuff, and they're keeping the dollar in their back pocket because it's the world reserve currency. It actually means something, right? So it's kind of like Gresham's law. Bad money drives out good. So this may not make any sense to your audience, but that's playing out in real time. Why would someone keep a unit of currency that's being debased day by day? We're adding $1 trillion every 100 days, I believe, now at this point, and our tax receipts are not coming up, or they're not sufficient to keep up with the rate of what we're spending, to where it's like, okay, when does this become unsustainable? Why would I want to save in dollars when I can save in this monetary fuel cell known as Bitcoin?
Yeah, there's a lot of truth there. And I think the recent bout of inflation and the ticking up of the national debt, that becomes more and more concerning to anybody who's paying attention, right? And I think seeing the national deficit increase substantially over the past couple of decades, and especially over the past few years, that does start, it starts to make you ask questions, because there are some people, the modern monetary theorists out there, who would say, well, there's no limit to the amount that the U.S. government can print money or can make spending obligations without increasing taxes. But I think most level-headed folks would disagree with that.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up MMT, Modern Monetary Theory. There's a good book called The Deficit Myth. And if your audience wants to hear both sides of this, because I'm not some like Bitcoin evangelist or propagandist, I'm someone who's just been studying money for a very long time. And Bitcoin is, in my opinion, a good answer to it. I think that The Deficit Myth, along with the books that I would recommend, would be a good counterbalance, and then they can make their own decision. But basically, MMT in a nutshell is that, hey, government balance sheet is not like our household balance sheet, to where you and I are teaching personal finance. You know, 1 + 1 = 2. you know, when it comes to MMT, you can just print the two and hope it doesn't inflate, right? So that may not be a good analogy, but what I'm trying to say is I think to balance out everything that I'm saying, people just need to do their own work and come to their own conclusion. I don't want anyone buying Bitcoin without understanding it, because they're not going to have the conviction to hold it during 60, 70, 80% drops.
Yeah, that's a good point too. You gotta know the why behind it so that you actually can stay the course. All right, we got just a few more questions to get to with you, Marco, including we want to talk about criminal activity in the Bitcoin or the crypto space. We'll get to a few more questions right after this.
When it comes to financial advice, you got to trust the source. That's why you listen to this podcast. And if you're looking to upgrade your wallet, you need to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. If you're paying for vacations with whatever card is in your wallet, you could be missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table.
You can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade, lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions.
Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week at the beach every single summer. We've already got that trip to St. Simon's on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host. Or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. Spring cleaning is kind of an annual rite of passage. We've all got to do it, minimize the junk that we have in our house. Emily and I, we just cleaned our closets out. It took hours, but it was so worth it. Now we've only got stuff in there that we love, and it's easier to find everything too. And so, you know, while cleaning your closets is helpful, well, there's something else you can do for your family this spring. Shopping for life insurance with Policy Genius, for example, is a really important part of your financial planning for the year.
That's right. Yeah. And here is the thing that's important to remember, because you might be thinking you don't need to check out Policy Genius because you've got a policy through work. But even if you have a life insurance policy through your job, it may not offer you enough protection for your family's needs, and it may not follow you if you leave your job. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. Policy Genius works for you, not the insurance companies, and that means they don't have an incentive to recommend one insurer over another, so you can trust their guidance.
Save time and money and provide your family with a financial safety net using Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com.
All right, we're back from the break talking with Marco from Whiteboard Finance, and obviously we're talking all about Bitcoin. But before we dive even deeper, Marco, I kind of want to, I guess, back out a little bit, maybe talk a little bit more about general personal finance, because from what I understand, are you completely debt-free?
Yeah, like literally debt-free.
Okay. So I'm curious, because like, what pushed you in that direction?
I had kids.
is it kids? Because on one hand, there's security, peace of mind. But on the other hand, when you are such, you believe in Bitcoin, you believe in the future of it and where it's going to go.
Or even taking Bitcoin out of the equation, if you had a low interest rate mortgage, stock and the historical average return of stocks, it doesn't necessarily make sense to pay off that debt, right?
If you're only looking at the numbers.
Yeah, paying off my house was the dumbest financial decision I've ever made, but here's the double-edged sword, is that I'm an entrepreneur. I don't know what my income is going to be tomorrow. you know, it just helps you sleep well at night, which is an emotional thing. So I think people need to just balance the two, right? So it's like I reduced, you know, my biggest expense in my life. I have no debt now. So it just allows me to be way more bullish in my convictions and in my investing. So in the, yes, you're foregoing the mathematics of it because especially in an inflationary environment, it makes no sense to pay off, you know, low interest rate debt. But at the same time, you know, if you want to live stress-free, that's also a benefit as well.
Sure. So dumb financial move, but smart personal move
and
for
you. And I love, too, like what you said, like it allows you to be more bullish with your investments because if you don't have the debt, if you don't have the recurring monthly payments that come along with having household debt, you can be a little more adventurous, I guess, when it comes to what you're investing in.
Yeah, 100%. And it's also a supercharge as well. And also, your audience knows this because they're smart, and you guys know this as well. I mean, the time value of money, a dollar today is worth more than a dollar, you know, 10 years from now. And when you're investing, especially when we talked about the chart going up and to the right, historically, you know, time is on your side. So yeah, that's why I did that. I could have plopped that into, you know, VTI, a total stock market fund, for example. But at the end of the day, I wanted to cross off that big debt first. And then now I can just pile loads of money into my investments and not have to think about it. Perfect example, you know, I smash bought, you know, $5,000 of Bitcoin a couple of weeks ago. I bought 1,000 last week. I dollar cost average every week into four specific index funds and ETFs. And I don't have to think twice about it.
Yeah. I like that. All right. How do you think about criminal activity in the cryptocurrency space? And does Bitcoin get an undeserved black eye because of maybe things that are happening with other crypto coins? And let's say the Sam Bankman-Fried FTX fiasco. How do you think, I don't know, Bitcoin's reputation is unfairly maligned because of some of that stuff happening? Or do you think there really are some criminal enterprises using Bitcoin for nefarious purposes?
Yeah, I think both those things are true. So I've been tweeting for years saying that Bitcoin needs to do a better job of kind of disassociating itself from crypto, if you will, because crypto, you have anything from, you know, great use cases that, you know, companies and governments are adopting all the way down to Geo Bowden, you know, Shiba Inu meme coin, right? So it runs the whole gamut. Again, from my background, from my educational background and my own personal education, I'm a sound money kind of guy, just because I think it provides lower time preference and helps people make decisions for the long term. And I think from that standpoint, I am a Bitcoin maximalist from a sound money standpoint. Are there other cryptos or coins or tokens or smart contracts or all that stuff that we can go down that provide value for other use cases? Yes, there can be. But again, from a sound money standpoint, I'm all about Bitcoin. The other question of like, is it used for illicit activity? Absolutely. Just like the dollar has been for hundreds of years, right? So fiat currency has been used for that as well. If you look at like HSBC literally getting fined for washing Mexican drug cartel money, you know, the dollar never gets those articles written about it. But if someone uses it to buy, you know, some weed or ecstasy or, you know, cocaine on the dark web, then Bitcoin is the worst thing ever created. So I just think it's whatever, you know, the media wants to focus on.
Yeah, no, that's true. I think oftentimes it's just a straw man argument, and there's not a whole lot behind that. But as far as some of the meme coins out there and the just even honestly some of the NFTs, do you think that the rise, because this is one of the interesting things, is oftentimes you do see correlated activity when it comes to Bitcoin and even just Ethereum. Like you said, there are use case scenarios for different coins out there. But even when it comes to the Shiba Inu coins, are they essentially just riding on the coattails and are they hanging out in the wake of Bitcoin and in the actual work that it's doing?
Yeah, absolutely. Bitcoin is
that's how you view
Bitcoin
it?
Okay. Is the signal. Everything else is the noise.
All right. So let's say we wake up 10 years from now, 2034. And what's going on with Bitcoin at that point in time?
You asking Marco to make a prediction?
Not even like, oh, this is the price it's going to be at. But like, what's happening in the Bitcoin world and what's going to happen? Like, what will people be feeling who listened to this in 2024 and they said, that's great for Marco, but I think I'm going to stick with my normal boring investing strategy that Matt and Joel talk about most of the time. How are those people going to be feeling a decade down the road?
Yeah, from like an adoption and technological standpoint, it's going to be the same as any other technology. I think innovations are going to be made. I think those layer two solutions are going to become much more easier to use, much more accessible. They're already happening. And then also, again, I'm not price prediction guy, but my base case is that it's a much, much, much better version of gold. And that would put Bitcoin at around $500,000 per Bitcoin. And I know that sounds insane, but whether you believe me or not, it's still the biggest asymmetric bet that you can make with the highest probability at this point in time without having to pick, you know, the NVIDIAs, the Teslas, the, you know, Metas, and, you know, wondering what the CEO is going to do and what the macro environment is going to be. I think the cat is out of the bag and the network and Lindy effects are just going to make it stronger. But that's not to say that, you know, it is volatile. It's very new. It's an infant technology, essentially. It's 15 years old. It's still on the early adopter side of the bell curve. But I think 10 years from now, I think, you know, we're going to be able to transact with it and use it without even thinking about it.
Yeah. No, you heard it here. 2034, $500,000 per Bitcoin.
That's
and
right.
Marco, you can rub it in our faces after you invite us over to enjoy some of those ribeyes.
That's right.
No, I don't want to rub anything in anyone's faces. I just I think it will behoove you to read these books. I'm not associated with any of these people, but I would read them in this specific order if you're genuinely interested. They're audiobooks. You can listen to them. You can there's a different ways to consume them, but it would be The Bullish Case for Bitcoin. It would be Inventing Bitcoin. It would be The Bitcoin Standard, Gradually Then Suddenly, Layered Money, The Price of Tomorrow, and then Broken Money. So you can
awesome.
Rewind that, but I'm not associated with any of these authors, I think it'll help provide some clarity.
Awesome. Right. Yeah, no, and we will absolutely. We'll link to every single one of those books in our show notes. And I'm going to check a couple of those out myself
from
our local library. But Marco, we really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us about Bitcoin, sharing your thoughts on it, and where can folks learn more about you? Well, obviously, they can head over to YouTube, Whiteboard Finance, and learn more about Bitcoin, but also just personal finance in general there as well. But where else can folks find you?
Yeah, so Whiteboard Finance on YouTube, Whiteboard Fin, F-I-N, on X or Twitter, and then Whiteboard Finance on Instagram. If you guys are interested, I don't want to plug anything, but I do have a private community where we've been talking about Bitcoin when it was significantly less than it is now, and people are paying for that membership 10 times over. It's just Whiteboard Finance University. It's a private community. We have professors. It's really good stuff.
Awesome. Marco, thank you so much for joining us today, man. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, guys.
Joel, isn't it refreshing to talk to somebody about something that is really complex, but oftentimes there are more emotions involved with how it is that you're thinking about something like this?
Yeah.
And I feel like Marco is able to just talk about it with a balanced perspective.
It brings the heart of a teacher, the Whiteboard Finance thing, man.
Exactly. That's what I felt the entire time.
And I felt like I was being taught, because honestly, I feel like I'm a second grader here on this stuff. So
when it comes to Bitcoin.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I know some, but like Marco knows a whole heck of a lot more, obviously. He's done the work, and so I really appreciate hearing his perspective, and I feel like it's worth having someone who's thoughtful, who kind of stems from, in a lot of ways, our thought process on how to handle money, but is also more pro-Bitcoin and has reasons for it.
Multiple levels deeper when it comes to understanding it, to the point that he is comfortable with investing, you know, over 15% of his overall portfolio within Bitcoin. But yeah, is that your big takeaway, that you're going to go all in? Go ahead and sell all your FC Rocks.
Yes.
Go all in.
Everything I own.
BTC, baby.
Yep. Even all my clothing items. Like, I'm just going to walk around in a loincloth, but I'll own a lot of Bitcoin. I think my big takeaway was when he said, like, what allocation's not going to cause you to lose sleep? And that is a really important thing. Like, it's possible to see other investments decline precipitously too, right? Volatility is the price of admission into the stock market. We discuss that regularly. And so if you don't feel comfortable seeing a 40%+ drop in your portfolio, potentially for multiple years on end, then you probably need to change your allocation so that you can sleep better at night when things get tough. And that is even more true of Bitcoin. So if you decide to read the books, and if you think that, you know, Marco's stance about Bitcoin being the hardest form of money ever created, if that makes sense to you, that resonates with you, I love the dollar cost averaging. Go slowly into it, and then just don't bite off more than you can chew. Don't take on so much risk that when that inevitable 80% decline happens, 60% decline, because Bitcoin, like I said, is even more volatile, that it's not going to cause you to freak out.
Yeah. My big takeaway is going to have to do with essentially around the halving event, and less of Bitcoin is being created. There's a set amount that's ever going to be created. And going back to when he was outlining some of the different properties of what makes money, what makes a currency, and scarcity. Like, the fact that we know exactly how much there's going to be, and the parallel to the U.S. and the ability to print money and deciding Jay Powell, like it all kind of comes down to him and how he says certain words. Doesn't that make that, it really makes that seem kind of crazy? Like you're trying to balance this ship on the head of a pin, as opposed to the predictability of knowing what's in store for us when it comes to Bitcoin. So I don't know, the scarcity argument that he made really stood out to me during this conversation.
And I also just appreciate his kind of delineation between Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. And there's the proof of work versus the proof of stake. There's a whole lot of reasons that Marco takes that approach and believes that Bitcoin is wholly different than crypto. And a lot of crypto products are riding the Bitcoin coattails. And so it does make me think more about not increasing my Bitcoin exposure past 5%, but at least making that kind of experimental 5% more Bitcoin heavy.
It certainly puts Bitcoin in a
different light.
Yeah, certainly. But okay, the beer, Joel, that you and I enjoyed during this episode was a Diamond Dust. This is a beer by Pure Project, donated to the show by Christy. What were your thoughts?
Dude, this was a delicious idea.
Wasn't it so good?
I was going to say three adjectives: light, zippy, and juicy. So thoroughly enjoyed it.
Hoppy, the tropical fruity notes were coming through like crazy. They describe it as a murky IPA. But Pure Project, it makes me, I don't know anything about this brewery, but we've got another beer from her. And before we have that beer, I'm going to look into Pure Project and see what they're all about. Because it makes me think that, sounds like they do something good, right?
Yeah, let's hope so.
but I just don't know what that thing
is. Something not dirty, folks.
So we'll report back. But Christy, thank you so much for donating this beer to the episodes. I feel like it's been a minute since I've had like a really good, surprisingly good IPA like this.
Yeah.
This one delighted me.
Definitely. Top notch. Thank you, Christy. All right, Matt, that's going to do it for this episode. We'll have links in the show notes to all those books that Marco mentioned and some other resources too, including Marco's YouTube channel. Mm-hmm. But Matt, that's going to do it for this one. Until next time, best friends out.
Best friends out.
Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy.
Yeah. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Fedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.